This program is brought to you by Suffolk University. Please visit us on the web at www.suffolk.edu.
This is Scott McEwen of Oblon Spivak. I am co-director of our post-grant practice group here at the firm and specialize in post-grant proceedings at the USPTO. My blog is patentspostgrant.com, which provides daily updates and explanations of not only developments in proceedings before the office and concurrent litigation, but also legislative efforts in the area of post-grant patent practice. And I've written extensively on the topic of the America Invents Act, post-grant review, inter-parties review, and other mechanisms of the legislation that impact that area of patent practice. Before getting into what post-grant review is, I think it's helpful to understand that sometimes post-grant review and the words post-grant are sometimes used fairly loosely. So post-grant, of course, would refer to anything that happens with respect to a patent at the USPTO after it's been issued. So, for example, if you're a patent owner or someone who's interested in challenging a patent, there are several post-grant type proceedings that you could look at. On the owner side, if you're looking at fixing an error or some kind of problem with your patent, you may file a patent reissue. You could file a certificate of correction. You could even seek reexamination of your own patent through an ex parte patent reexamination proceeding. On the other hand, if you're a challenger, you're mainly looking at ways to send some information back to the patent office to prove that the patent never should have issued in the first instance. And so post-grant review is a new mechanism for a challenger to do exactly that. In the past, the only proceedings that were available to a challenger were referred to as patent reexamination. So to understand a little bit about what post-grant review is, it's helpful to understand what the previous alternative was, which was patent reexamination, and what some of the problems, at least from the public's perception, existed with that proceeding. So if you look at patent reexamination, in order to challenge a patent at the PTO, you would have to submit prior art references, so some kind of publication or technical explanation that was out there in the public that would tend to disprove the patentability of a patented claim. So typically speaking, a challenger would get together some technical articles or even some previously issued patents, explain to the patent office why these teachings, these technical teachings, rendered the patent invalid, and at that point, the office would then conduct the formal reexamination to determine whether or not the requester was correct. In some cases, the requester would be able to participate in this proceeding if it was an inter-parties proceeding, or in other cases, if it was an ex-party proceeding, it would just be up to the patent owner to have this conversation with the patent office on whether or not the patent should stand or not. So some of the problems with these proceedings, at least from the perspective of a challenger, was that they took too long. It's not uncommon for a reexamination proceeding, once initiated, to take several years. In the case of inter-parties patent reexamination in particular, it could take anywhere from 5 to 7 years if the proceeding was fully contested all the way through the patent office and into the federal courts. As you can imagine, when you're faced with a problem patent that's impacting your business, 5 to 7 years is too long to wait. Another problem with reexamination, at least from a challenger's perspective, is that there's no discovery. And what I mean by discovery is litigation type exchange of information, the ability to take depositions from, for example, maybe there's an expert who's submitting an opinion in the reexamination. The PTO does not provide any way to cross-examine that witness to determine whether or not their opinions are really plausible or not. And then finally, since the reexamination proceedings were based only on patents and printed publications, there were certain arguments that the PTO just would not consider. For example, if you wanted to allege that the claims were indefinite or that the subject matter that was claimed was not adequately supported by the patent, it wasn't clear, the claims were drafted to subject matter which the patentee was not entitled to, you couldn't bring those things up in reexamination. Likewise, you could not argue that the claims were not statutory subject matter, which sometimes comes up in the biotech area. So there were these limitations on the requester side. On the patent owner side, the complaint was when prior art was submitted in a reexamination proceeding, roughly 94% of these reexamination filings were initiated by the patent office without seeking any information or any feedback whatsoever from the patentee. So the scales were tilted in favor of the Challenger in many respects. When you consider all of those shortcomings back both on the requester and the patent owner side, you can understand a little bit the way that PGR is now proposed to be implemented as a proceeding at the PTO. So what PGR offers is a little bit to both sides. So on the requester side, where timing was a big problem, now the proceeding has to be finished within 12 months of being initiated, or 18 months if the patent office can show cause as to why the proceeding should take a little bit longer. So whereas the reexamination proceeding would first go to an examiner, then go to an administrative patent judge at the PTO, and then on to the federal courts, the PGR proceeding goes directly to the judges at the PTO. So there's no longer an examination phase. There's just this adjudicative phase that's 12 months, and then if someone wants to appeal to the federal courts, they can do that thereafter. So immediately you can see that there's a big difference in speed. Before getting to the patent owner side, I also mentioned that there's this lack of discovery in reexamination proceedings. So post-grant review will have limited discovery for things, as I mentioned, such as cross-examining experts that are submitting opinions in the proceeding. So that speaks to the deficiencies that third-party requesters felt existed in current reexamination practices. On the patent owner side, you'll recall I mentioned that some of the complaints were that the bar was set too low in effect, and that roughly 94% of these proceedings were initiated based upon what was previously in reexamination, a substantial new question of patentability standard. That standard is very low. Basically, it amounts to, would this prior art be of interest to a reasonable examiner? So that's a very low standard. The PGR standard is whether or not the proposed rejections are more likely than not to ultimately invalidate a claim of the patent. So the bar has been raised a little bit to knock down that 94% number. In addition to that, before initiating the PGR, the patentee will have an opportunity to submit comments to the PTO to try to persuade the office that perhaps the submission isn't as strong as it looks. So when you look at those changes, you can understand where they've come from. Also, I mentioned that there were certain things you could not bring up in patent reexamination, what we refer to as a 112 or a 101 rejection, which roughly refer to whether or not the claims are clear enough or supported, or whether or not the claims relate to non-statutory subject matter. You will be able to bring up all of these issues in a PGR filing. That's the definition of what a post-grant review is, kind of in terms of where we've come from, to explain really what Congress was hoping to address in this new proceeding, which is to provide a more robust challenge at the PTO and to address some of the historical problems as seen from the participants of these proceedings, which is the patent owner and the challenger or third-party requester. The key thing to know about post-grant review is that it's not something that you're going to be able to use really anytime soon. And the reason for that is, although technically speaking, you could theoretically file a request for post-grant review on September 16, 2012, the class of patents that are eligible for this new proceeding are the ones that are referred to as the first inventor to file patents. So the American Invents Act, in addition to providing these new post-grant challenges, changed the U.S. system in terms of how inventorship is determined. So that change does not kick in until March of 2013. So if you look at it from, you can think of them as this new regime of patents that will first start to come into the patent office in March of 2013, and it will take a couple years for the PTO to start issuing these patents. It's probably not until 2015 before there will be patents that are issued from the office that are available for post-grant review. There is a slight exception in that there's a specific flavor of post-grant review that applies to business method patents, and those business method patents are not tied to this new first inventor to file regime. So the first post-grant reviews that will be filed will be strictly business methods. So post-grant review will take a significant amount of time to ramp up, and for reasons that I may get into later, it remains to be seen whether or not post-grant review will be embraced by the public. One of the reasons that it's expected that it will not be embraced, despite the fact that it sounds good and you can bring up all of these additional challenges, it cuts both ways because there's an estoppel provision of post-grant review. So if you're able to basically go into the patent office and challenge on more or less any possible invalidity ground, if you lose, you will then have no invalidity defenses in any later infringement case. So it may be that post-grant review is a bit too robust for the very cautious challenger that wants to sort of have their cake and eat it too. Typically in reexamination, although you can't challenge on every ground, the fact that you can't do that kind of indirectly saves some defenses for a later litigation should that eventuality come to pass. So those are some of the major issues that I think practitioners need to know about post-grant review in terms of what do I need to know about it right now. The legislation was enacted on September 16, 2011, so the statutes are clear. There's been some suggestion that there may be some further technical amendments to some quirky estoppel issues that is probably not worth getting into. But some of the other unsettled issues right now is, although the legislation's been enacted, the PTO is in the process of issuing rulemaking packages on exactly how these proceedings will be implemented. So down into the nuts and bolts of how the discovery is going to work, what the requests are going to look like, how many pages, for example, you'll be able to submit. Right now, the PTO is proposing, I believe it's 70 pages. That may migrate towards 100 once the public's comments are taken into account. Another big point of debate right now is the fees. What are these things going to cost? The fee schedule that's been proposed by the Patent Office a few weeks ago, the filing fee for post-grant review is, if you're looking to challenge 20 claims of a patent, the filing fee for that right now is $35,800. And that's a pretty hefty fee compared to what an inter-parties reexamination would be, which would roughly be about $10,000. But the real point of contention with practitioners and the public is this idea that that fee goes up depending upon the number of claims that you're looking to challenge. So, for example, if you were looking to challenge a patent that had 60 claims, you would be paying a $90,000 filing fee. So the idea of linking the filing fee to the number of claims, that's something that may change down the road once these final proposed rules come out in the summer of 2012. So that's something to keep an eye on. The statute requires, as I mentioned, that the PTO finish these proceedings within 12 months or at the latest 18 months, assuming the director can show cause. So the pressure will certainly be on the PTO, similar to what happens in the International Trade Commission, which also has to finish proceedings as soon as reasonably practical. I guess the open question would be the PTO has had to create, or I should say expand, the trial section and create a new patent trial and appeal board. So there's a lot of administrative manpower that has to go into these proceedings. There's a lot of hiring that's going on right now to staff up and to bring in the judges to handle all these additional trials. So while the legislation provides for a very quick timeline, implementation is an open question. And should these things become very popular and there are hundreds filed every year, the PTO may struggle to meet that timeline, but in the short term, I would expect that they'll be able to meet it at least for the first couple of years, and like I said, unless these things become very, very popular. The post-grant review impact, I think, will be fairly minimal. There is another proceeding called inter-parties review, which I expect will be much more widely embraced than post-grant review. And part of the reason for that, as I mentioned, post-grant review, you can make any challenge. And while that's nice in some respects, it's also very daunting in that you're trusting, in effect, the patent office to sort of get things right. And if the PTO sort of stumbles out of the gate and loses the public's confidence, there are very few companies that are sort of going to bet their $100 million cases by submitting every possible defense to the PTO. So the estoppel is a big drag on post-grant review and how likely it is to be embraced by too many challengers. It may be of most interest to the biotech pharma community because, as I mentioned, you will be able for the first time to bring up these 112 and 101 challenges, and by and large, those types of defenses are much more important to biotech pharmaceutical patents. So when you think about the estoppel, the fact that the public may be a little leery about giving all of their defenses, handing them over to the PTO, and the fact that for most companies that are embroiled in patent disputes, 112 and 101 aren't big defenses outside the biotech pharma community. And in addition to the fact that this proceeding will not practically be available until 2015, it's something that's going to have a long ramp up, in my opinion. And going forward, I would expect that the companies that do decide to use post-grant review are probably going to be in the biotech pharma area, and they're probably going to be challenging continuation patent applications that come out years after, you know, let's say, for example, a certain blockbuster drug is patented. And what the drug companies will try to do is keep the continuations active. So it may be a worthwhile venture for a biotech company to challenge continuations that come out of the patent office as an alternative to litigation. But outside of those limited circumstances, it's not going to be very helpful for companies that are looking at patent troll suits and the like. For that, I think inter-parties review will be the more robust proceeding and likely to be much more popular than post-grant review.
This preceding program was brought to you by Suffolk University. Please visit us on the web at www.suffolk.edu.